Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer Radio Show, brought to you by Tractor Supply, where we give away more chicken coops and chicken-related prizes than anyone else on the planet. We are often imitated, but never duplicated. My name is Andy Schneider, but most know me as the Chicken Whisperer, author of The Chicken Whisperer's Guide to Keeping Chickens, and national spokesperson for the USDA Biosecurity for Birds program. Today is Thursday, August 8th, and I would like to thank all of you for tuning in this afternoon on Blog Talk Radio. This is a live radio show that is broadcast around the world. This radio show is all about keeping backyard poultry, show poultry, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Each week, we welcome experts in their field to share their knowledge about different topics, including backyard poultry, show poultry, heritage poultry, gardening, cooking, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Be sure to visit our new website, chickenwhisperer.com, where you can follow us on Twitter and become a fan on Facebook. Once again, I would like to thank all of you for tuning in to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, brought to you by Tractor Supply.
Ware Manufacturing has been building quality hutches since 1983. Ware manufactures modern chicken hutches, barns, pens, and nest boxes designed especially for the backyard flock. Ware offers hutches and pens for every yard size and every chicken keeper's budget. Visit their website at waremfginc.com. That's waremfginc.com. Or call them to find a retailer near you at 1-888-824-7257. Ware Manufacturing.
And you can find all the great Ware products here.
Critter-Cages.com is your one-stop shop for all your critters' housing needs. They stock a wide selection of supplies and equipment for rabbits, guinea pigs, hamsters, mice, rats, ferrets, chinchillas, chickens, and other small critters. Their chicken selection includes chicken barns, chicken coops, and chicken yards from top manufacturers. Your critters will love their selection of quality products, and you'll love their low prices. Visit them online at critter-cages.com. That's critter-cages.com.
Mount Healthy Hatcheries has been a hatching tradition for over 80 years. Home of the healthiest chicks, Mount Healthy Hatcheries offers a wide selection of bantams, turkeys, guineas, ducks, pheasants, and of course, meat birds and layers. Order online at mounthealthy.com. That's mthealthy.com. Or give them a call at 1-800-451-5603. Don't forget to ask about their free bonus chicks offer. Mount Healthy Hatcheries, home of the healthiest chicks.
Hey, it's the Chicken Whisperer. If you're in the market for a new incubator, then look no further than GQF. They have a great selection of tabletop and cabinet-style incubators at prices you can afford. I love my GQF Genesis Model 1588. It has a large picture window and an automatic thermostat, which makes for a better hatch every time. Go pick out your new incubator at gqfradio.com. That's gqfradio.com.
Hey, it's the Chicken Whisperer, here to tell you that if you have backyard poultry, nothing is more important than making sure your feathered friends are safe from infectious poultry diseases. Learn the simple steps to keep your birds healthy by visiting this website, healthybirds.aphis.usda.gov. That's healthybirds.aphis.usda.gov.
A message from the USDA.
And the mighty bird against prejudice continues his fight for law and order. So when you hear that cry in the sky, you'll know it's Super Chicken.
All righty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. We really appreciate it. Yes, we do. And it is Thursday. It is the second Thursday of the month. So guess what? We've got Richard Krutenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine. He's going to be joining us today, and he is awesome. One of our most popular shows, and let me tell you, you love it when he's on. You love his topics, so you might as well subscribe to his publication that's been around for over 20 years, Back Home Magazine. Great information, chock full of great, let me rephrase, useful information, especially if you own or live on a homestead or you want to live a more self-sustaining lifestyle. That is the publication to get. Very, very affordable and tons of information. So, we're going to have a great time today with Richard Krutenberger. Get those Chicken Whisperer notebooks out. And we have a unique topic today that we have never had before on the show. Now, many of you know, our longtime listeners know from day one, this show is never intended to be just about chickens. Some of our new listeners, we have to remind them about this. Since day one, over coming up 5 years, this is our fifth year of broadcasting, it's always been about backyard poultry and living a self-sufficient lifestyle, which means things that you may have to do around your homestead. And so Richard has, at least for the last couple of years, been joining us to talk about different topics, anything from cooking with cast iron, best woods for the wood stove, geothermal heating, solar power, insect control, bug control, rodent control, predator control, all kinds of great things. And so today we have a neat situation, which I have a few of these around the homestead. I'm sitting in front of one right now. Many people have these, whether it's a wood splitter or an RV or just a landscape type or maybe a box type that you keep supplies in. But today's topic is how to prevent trailer theft. And 'tis the season. It's summer. Boat trailer, RVs, SUV trailers, the ATV trailers for your four-wheelers. I've heard numerous times from people where they were a contractor, and they went around and they had all their equipment, thousands of dollars, maybe tens of thousands of dollars in their trailer that they use for work, stolen right out from under them. Boom. Just like that. I heard recently on the news about a Boy Scout trailer that got stolen from behind a church that they used to travel with, band trailers. So we hear about this a lot. You may have been a victim of trailer theft. And today, with our topic about homesteading and useful information around the homestead, Richard Krutenberger is going to join us, Back Home Magazine, talking about how to prevent trailer theft today. So get those notebooks out and learn from the best. So thank you very much for tuning in. I want to send a real quick shout out to everybody who's listening live and those that can actually get into the chat room. We thank you very much for making it a lively chat room on a regular basis. But I also want to thank all the archive listeners, and there are thousands of you that listen to the show, and we thank you very much. iTunes.com, podcast.com, Zoom.com, and others that carry the radio show, literally thousands. Thousands of you, and we appreciate that so much from the bottom of our heart. The homeschooler school is in session. Most schools have started now. Some start in the next 2 weeks. So thank you, homeschoolers, for making this daily show every day at noon a part of your everyday curriculum. We thank you, and good luck to you this year. Everybody should learn something every single day of their life to make it interesting. And I've got a segue to that here in just a second. So thank you very much. Over the road truck drivers, we hear from you. Thank you. Keep the rubber on the road. And all the feed and seed stores around the country that stream this radio show live to their customers, thank you very much for doing so. Already yesterday during the show, well, we've had great shows all week. We had the Chicken Doctor Peter Brown on Monday. Tuesday, we had our good old friend Andrew Odom talking about a new project he's working with Tiny House Revolution. Yesterday, what a great show, all about backyard vineyards and wine. It's a two-part series. We ask you to listen to both parts. Both are chock full of great related information about wine. If you're a wine connoisseur or think you are, great, great topic. Even if you're not, even if you're just a lay wine drinker, then lots of great topics were discussed with Garden Wise Living with Arlena yesterday. And 2 weeks ago yesterday, part one with Backyard Vineyards. And then, of course, today, Richard Frudenberger, How to Prevent Trailer Theft. So yesterday on my Facebook page, and I even think it was before the radio show, I had posted an article, and I read it on the show, about salmonella. And it sparked a little debate, not really a debate, but several comments on our Facebook page. And I'd just like to cover that right now because I've got a little bit more information for you. Okay? Yesterday, I posted an article that said CDC warns about salmonella outbreaks from backyard chickens. And it was an article from Denver, Colorado, and they apparently interviewed a backyard chicken keeper and who had chickens, I guess, for a little while, and she keeps them as quote-unquote pets. Like so many people nowadays, they have Daisy and Lulu and Precious and Petunia, and they're part of the family, and we understand that. We've had plenty of chickens named on our homestead as well. But I'll just read the article again real quick and then cover a few things before we bring Richard on. As the urban farming movement continues to grow in Colorado, health officials are raising a red flag about salmonella outbreaks linked to backyard flocks. There is particular concern about people bringing chickens into their homes and treating them as pets or lap chickens, complete with chicken diapers. Mary, a Denver resident who did not want to reveal her last name, has even launched a business selling the diapers. "They're just really, really tame, and they want to be near humans," said Mary, petting her two chickens, Henny and Penny. "I wouldn't have them in the house all the time, but once in a while it's nice to let them in." But a CDC warning, health officials say that they are investigating two large multi-state outbreaks of salmonella tied to backyard flocks. One strain sickened people in 37 states, including 31 people in Colorado alone. One person died from that strain. Some people were reportedly kissing or cuddling with the birds, according to CDC investigators. The CDC said even poultry that appears healthy and clean can still be shedding germs that make people sick, and chickens should not be allowed inside people's homes. Candace, that's one reason why the bird flu issue over in Asia is people are having close quarters, living with their chickens in the same environment, in the same room, in the same area. They don't have clean, fresh running water, clean sources of water. We just add that 2 cents regarding the bird flu over there and the issues they're having because people are living with their chickens. Candace Burns Hoffman, a spokesman for the National Center for Emerging and Zoonotic Infectious Diseases with the CDC, said an email to 7 News, just like you wouldn't walk around your house touching surfaces with raw, uncooked chicken, you also wouldn't allow your live poultry to have contact with surfaces in your home. In 2012 alone, public health officials uncovered 8 outbreaks in which people got sick with germs spread from contact with poultry and backyard flocks. These outbreaks caused at least 517 illnesses, 93 hospitalizations, and 4 deaths, according to the CDC. Health officials said for every case of salmonella reported to the CDC, there are about 30 that go not reported. The people most at risk for getting a serious illness from contact with live poultry include young children, people with weakened immune systems, and adults older than 55 years of age. People become infected with salmonella germs when they put their hands or other things that have been in contact with animal droppings in or around their mouth. Young children are especially at risk for illness because their immune systems are still developing and because they are more likely than others to put their hands or fingers in or around their mouths. Now, famous last words here from Mary. We don't know her last name. "I never had a problem, and I don't think most people would." She said there's no difference between her chickens and other pet birds, except her chickens give her something back. "There you go," she said, lifting up a brown egg. "I love fresh eggs." And so now that you've got the story, I'm going to go back to our Facebook page, and I'll elaborate on what I put. In parentheses, I put, "I wonder if the dead people in this story actually said, quote, like Mary, I never had a problem, and I don't think most people would. Famous last words, right? The solution can be a simple one. Wash your hands. However, things happen, and sometimes we forget. Our kids get their hands in their mouths before we can wash their hands. A lot of times, you just have to use common sense. Now, it sparked a pretty good debate on our Facebook page, over 30 comments worth, and I'm just going to go down here and get a few, and of course, I have one that says, thanks for the update. And, of course, they're no different than any other pet. Wash your hands, specifically regarding a lot of the external poop that may contain the salmonella. And common sense is the key phrase. I love my chickens, but come on, they're not house pets. We've got, let's see, here's one, I love this. In my 40-plus years of having backyard chickens, I've never had a problem. Okay, but that does not mean that she could die tomorrow or the next day from a salmonella poisoning outbreak. That means nothing. And we go down here, it said, I had salmonella once, and it was the sickest that I've ever been in my life, but I got it from McDonald's eating an Egg McMuffin. Let's see, we've got, I have at least 60 chickens, and I've never been sick. Okay, we have that as well. Now, I've responded to some of that because after many years of being on Facebook and reporting even factual information, this is what we actually posted. Yes, the numbers are relatively small based on the U.S. population. There is, however, still a risk involved. So just put it in perspective, however, with other daily risks. For example, every drug recalled by the FDA as unsafe was first approved by the FDA as safe. Now, without a doubt, and I firmly believe this with every ounce of my being, after 5 years of doing this on Facebook, I could post on my Facebook page that eating a raw bowl of arsenic every day is not good for you. And I assure you, somebody would post that they've been doing it for years and have had no problems. You know what I'm talking about. So what we have here, another young lady, Christina, you can see it on our Facebook page. She put, no salmonella in my Moran eggs. Now, you may pronounce it Moran, Moran, or Marin, but she put, no salmonella in my Moran eggs. And basically my response to her was, really? When did you send your eggs to be tested? And then she put, it's a fact. The pores in Moran eggs are smaller than other eggs, so it cannot get in them. Check it out. And so I put, hey, Christina, can you please send me the study that proves that? I've contacted poultry scientist and professor Dr. Bridget McRae, Ph.D., and will contact the CDC tomorrow and find out if that information is backed by scientific proof. It might be, but I can't find it anywhere. Where did you see it or find it? Since I've never heard about it, I want to either prove it right or wrong, so please let me know. And, she put, she'll do that. She said she's seen it on other chicken sites. There's our first kind of warning flag. I've seen it all over other chicken sites, and it seems to be common knowledge. If you search Moran egg salmonella, you will see what I mean. Even the Moran Club would have info. I would like to know about scientific fact, though. Please let me know what you get on it. And I responded, this morning I heard back from Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor, who comes on every Monday here. While having a tougher shell will help prevent contamination from external pathogens, it will do nothing to stop salmonella or any other pathogen from entering the egg from the infected hens. Salmonella generally comes from hens that are infected with any number of different strains of salmonella rather than an external environment that is contaminated with salmonella. This morning, I got off the phone with my good friend and co-author of The Chicken Whisperer's Guide to Keeping Chickens, Dr. Bridget McRae, Ph.D., poultry scientist and professor, and she said that she would love to talk to Christina to basically set the record straight. If you would like to talk with her, Christina, please send an email to me, and I will get you in contact with her. So here's my layman terms answer from my talk with Dr. McRae. Basically, a hard shell and smaller pores will do nothing to prevent vertical contamination of the egg if the hen is infected. The salmonella is contained in the yolk and white even before the egg is formed around it inside the hen. She also explained that even if the eggshell did have smaller pores, they are probably not smaller than the salmonella bacteria and would not prevent horizontal contamination from outside the shell. Again, these are my layman's terms based on our conversation with the doctor this morning, and she can explain it much better if you are interested. So, gotta love it. So, we're gonna keep investigating this, and Dr. McRae said she'd be more than happy to talk with the poster on this Facebook page, Christina, about that. But again, just because a lot of people are thinking about salmonella regarding the chicken poop, and people know that the chicken's eggs have a bloom on them. It's that coating. It is the last thing that the hen actually places on the egg before it is laid. It is called the bloom, and it does protect the inside of the egg somewhat from all the nasties on the outside of the egg, which would include urites and poo and anything else that might be in the chicken poo or now in the nest box and whatnot. So we get that and we understand that. A lot of people talk about salmonella, especially around Easter time when kids are touching the chickens, touching the chicken poo, cleaning out the brooders, and then touching their mouths and getting salmonella from the poo that actually comes out of that baby chick or that chicken. There is also, which would be the horizontal contamination from a source outside of the egg, whether it's on the eggshell, on the ground, in the chicken poo, on the chicken's feet, and then you put it in your mouth that way. And then, of course, there's the vertical contamination of salmonella. If your bird happens to be infected with salmonella, your bird itself, okay, then when the egg is in the process of being made inside the hen, when you've got the dropping of the yolk from the ovary and the additive of the albumin and the white, it all becomes one, and then the egg shell is basically placed around that. The salmonella is already there. It's already in there. And so once the egg is sealed, then the salmonella is already in that egg. It pops out of the chicken's vent, and there it is. So would there be salmonella in that poo? Maybe. So no matter how well you wash that egg, you could wear gloves to collect the egg. You wash that, and hopefully, you will actually cook the egg properly to kill that salmonella in the egg. If you eat that egg that is contaminated with the salmonella from inside the hen before the shell's put on, then you could end up risking the chance of actually getting salmonella yourself, and nobody wants that, obviously. So no matter how thick the shell, no matter any of that, if that hen has been infected with salmonella, and it's going to be inside that egg, no matter how thick the shell is or how small the pores are. It's already inside. And again, very simply, cooking it properly will kill that salmonella, so you shouldn't have anything to worry about if cooking it food properly. But it just kind of started a little debate on there, and I've told and I posted on there. Many of you know, people have met me when I'm on tour, when we do the workshops, when I'm doing my book signings, they say, look, hey, he's a nice guy. He's laid back. He's cool. He never claims to be an expert at anything, and I don't, and I never have. If you find that anywhere that I have claimed to be an expert at anything, I will give you a $100 bill. Okay, there's my promise to you. I will give you a $100 bill if you can find anywhere that I say that I am an expert at anything. No, I am basically a liaison. I sometimes consider it like a sportscaster. That sportscaster may not be an expert at anything or at sports. They are just a liaison to bring the experts to his listeners, to the people watching him. And so when we started the show, and we've always said, I share my experiences with people, specifically new timers. We want them to raise chickens the right way the first time without having to reinvent the wheel. But when it gets to more technical information, all I do is bring the experts that we find on the radio show, on the podcast, and let them share their expertise. They're the ones with all the letters behind their name. They're the ones with years and years and years of experience in the labs doing research. Again, a lot of people say there's more than one way to skin a cat. I've been keeping chickens for 30 years. I have a lot of experience. That's great. There's more than one way to raise a kid, just like there's more than one way to raise a chicken. That is exactly right, but they are not experts. They are not scientists. They don't have the training. They may have experience. That's all I do. But I've never claimed to be an expert, period, especially with backyard poultry. And you can tell that by even reading the book. That's not what I do. Don't claim to be an expert at absolutely anything. But we just basically use this as a segue, this show, and I, the liaison, between the experts that are out there with all the degrees who do this every day full-time for a living and teach this to students, to us, backyard poultry keepers, and so we can learn about our backyard poultry. That's all it's about. So I told her there's a lot of bad information on blogs and forums out there. You know what? I know it. There's some good information out there, too. Don't get me wrong. But you know, if someone reads something on a chicken forum or a chicken blog, they just automatically immediately take it to be true. You know, they don't find out where this was created, who started it, is there scientific research to back it up. And you know, I'm not one to just say it's not good if it doesn't have scientific research. You've listened to me and Dr. McCrae talk, and she's really formed my opinions on a lot of things throughout the years, her and Peter Brown, just like when I was talking about apple cider vinegar. On the show one day, I said, you know, I use apple cider vinegar in the summertime in my waterers because it seems to prevent a lot of that algae buildup, or at least quick algae buildup, before I get back and can clean the waters again in a few days. And Dr. McCrae may say, well, show me the proof that that's true. And I'm like, you know, the proof is my two eyes in my head. When I go out there and I don't use the apple cider vinegar, there's more green algae buildup in the hot summer months on this plastic waterer. And when I use it, there's less. And I see that and I experience that every day. But again, it may not be as easy as black and white. You know, yes, there's a study that proves it. No, there's not a study that proves it. So it's just one of those things. And that's a perfect example of why I use apple cider vinegar, but there may not be an exact study. Who's going to pay for that study to say, yeah, it keeps the algae down? Well, I see it every day. But one of my favorite analogies is when we see people post something. I'm just going to use this as an example. They'll see it on a forum or a blog that says, pumpkin seeds prevent internal parasites and worms. You say, well, how do you know? Well, I've been giving pumpkin seeds to my chickens, and they don't have any internal parasites or worms. Well, how do you know? Because I don't see them. Okay? Have you ever had your chickens tested? Have you ever had a fecal flotation test to see if they have worms or not? You can't see them all. Well, no, but I don't see them, so that it works. I've never had to worm my chickens before. Okay? Someone seeing that and takes it for granted and as factual information could be harming their flock, bottom line. It would be no different than me, and I've done this in the past, saying, attention everybody, Twinkies prevent cancer. Yes. Why? I eat one Twinkie every day. I'm 43 years old, and I don't have cancer. So by golly, Twinkies prevent cancer, period. I could post that, and some people, I guess, would think it as factual information. Maybe not, because it sounds a little ridiculous, but it's the same premise of, guess what, everybody? Pumpkin seeds prevent worms and chickens. Well, how and why do you know that? So it's, somebody's not happy. So it's just, that's kind of what I'm getting at here. I'm not an expert at anything, but I try to have the experts in their field on the show to share their knowledge so we can all, you and me, learn about our backyard poultry, do it right the first time, keep them healthy. That's what it's all about, keeping them healthy. So, Dee in the chat room says, I think Twinkies could actually really prevent cancer. Maybe they'll make us live longer because they're so full of preservatives, and that's going to preserve our bodies, so we'll live to 150 maybe, I don't know. So apparently Twinkies are back on the shelves, or they're going to be close to being back on the shelves. The company that took them over is producing them now, I guess. I don't know. I have not had a Twinkie in probably over 30 years. I think the last Twinkie I had was when I was literally having to hold my mommy's hand going into the grocery store, and they had, I remember, a Twinkie, a guy or a girl standing outside the store in a Twinkie outfit, a human Twinkie, if you will, waving, giving them away for free to promote them. So this was back, again, I remember holding my mom's hand and saying, oh, look, it's Mr. Twinkie, and getting a free Twinkie. That may be the last time I've ever actually ate a Twinkie. So very, very interesting information. But I just wanted to share that with you. because it happened as recent as on our Facebook page, and it's just something that I share with you that what we like to do here on the show. So without further ado, I see in the chat room here, or actually on the in the caller queue, that we've got Richard Frudenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine, joining us. We've got a very interesting topic today. Many of us own trailers, whether it be a log splitter or a landscape trailer or an RV or a boat or a utility vehicle trailer. You know, like I said earlier, I've talked to several contractors. They park a trailer behind their house. It gets stolen with tens of thousands of their woodworking equipment in it. We've heard about Boy Scout trailers being stolen on a regular basis. We've heard about church trailers being stolen, wood splitters, you know, all this stuff. And so I thought it would be an interesting topic, and that's what we're going to be covering today with our good friend Richard Frudenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine. You can find them online, backhomemagazine.com. Let's give Richard a big chicken whisper. Welcome. Hey, Richard, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, sure. Happy to be here.
Hey, are you up in that area in the foothills of Appalachia? Are y'all getting covered up with rain as well the last few months?
Oh, yeah, definitely. We have flooding. We have, I believe, as much our annual rainfall was reached at the end of June, I think it was. In other words,
wow.
We have another 6 months, or maybe six and a half months to go, and we still, or 5.5 months to go, and we've passed our normal annual rainfall.
That's crazy. Now, are you seeing an increase up in that area? Bugs, insects, mosquitoes, snakes,
yes,
things
yes,
coming out of the
yes,
woodwork?
Yes, to all of them. Snakes, snakes, mosquitoes, gnats, anything that lives in Kentucky 31 fescue, you know, or anything that grows. Yes, it's mosquitoes are a real problem, and wildlife like snakes and other some of the other things like that are seeking higher ground. I guess that's their problem, and they're out and about more than normal.
Yeah, we here at the campground we're staying just this week. There were two rattlesnakes. Saw one went away, and one was terminated just because it's a campground, lots of children and whatnot. They're saying they seemed, and even bears, and they normally see bears in this area, but maybe a few more actually right now, more recently, back-to-back sightings here, near, mainly trying to get that free meal out of the trash can or the dumpster. But, yeah, the rattlesnakes kind of concerning some folks around here, so I just thought, you know, contributing that to all the rain we've had. And is that, I'm trying to think, I guess, I don't know if a lot of rain this part of the season would really affect anything that happens or goes on in wintertime, at least not on the top of my head, but at least right now with all the insects and the bugs and the critters and things, we're definitely seeing an increase here, and we've had a boatload of rain, too. I don't know, it's affected my garden, and I know it's affected a lot of the corn across the country in the wet areas, so that maybe we may see our corn go even higher due to the wet. Farmers can't get in the field, they can't, you know, use their equipment, harvest, or actually plant, so you know, there's some issues there with that right now in the rainy area. So we've got an interesting topic. We've never had it on the radio show before regarding our homesteading segments with you at Back Home Magazine, and how to prevent trailer theft in and around the home and homestead.
Yeah, it's a little unusual, but I think it's real practical. The reason I chose it was because it's not just as you say one kind of trailer, and we may not all own trailers, but probably a good many of the listeners own some type of trailer or some type of equipment they pull behind a truck or SUV, and as you said, that includes camping trailers, the Boy Scout trailers, the maybe a utility trailer of some type. Certainly landscapers or part-time landscapers who maybe make a few extra bucks in the summer, their little trailers with their mowers and rakes and weed whackers and that kind of thing. You've got log splitters this time of year. You know, it's gonna, a lot of people, if they're doing it right, they'll be splitting their logs in the summer so they can use the heat and the time to have them dry by the winter. People who have... Who do mortar mixers, anything like that gets pulled behind. What else do we have? ATV trailers, jet ski trailers, boats especially. That's another big thing in the summer. Just any kind of boat, you know, from a little aluminum skiff to, you know, with your little, you know, 11 horsepower motor on it, all the way up to the bigger bass boats. And just anything that hooks on the tongue of your back of your truck or SUV or station wagon or whatever, you're all open to potential theft and a lot more easily or a lot more available than you think as far as being a target. Because one of the things that I've learned in looking into this is that a lot of those trailer thefts are not done by professionals. They're done by opportunists. Somebody may drive up, you say Saturday afternoon or something, you pull up to a crowded diner or a restaurant or something, and there's no room in the normally in the front of the lot, so you pull in the back or maybe way, way in the back, and because there's so many customers, and, you know, you park your car with the trailer in the back and go in to eat and don't think anything about it. Well, you know, same time somebody's cruising the back lots, they're just looking for exactly that, unprotected equipment. So, you know, a lot of people are just looking for fast cash, or they're just that's how they supplement their income, is by stealing things and turning them around quickly. If the trailer has stuff in it, like weed whackers or mowers or whatever, that's another, you know, it's not just the trailer they're getting, but it's also the equipment in it. And
I got to share, this is so funny in the chat room. Bea has posted, she said, I've got an old boat trailer filled with brush, flat tires, just sitting by the road, and I wish somebody would take it.
Yeah, well, maybe that's the thing, is hook it up and park it behind the diner. That would be the way to get rid of it.
I've even heard you talking about kind of crime of opportunity. I've heard of folks back when I was fishing a tournament over the winter. This was probably 20 years ago. People would come back in their bass boats. They'd come back and they'd go up, and their trailer would be gone. And they would come to the boat ramp and find out wherever the best trailers were, and then bye bye, see you later. And they would they'd come in from the tournament, and their trailer would be gone, just like that.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of that has been helped, or I guess hindered. I guess the word is that a lot of the theft has been hindered by the fact that registration on trailers and license plates and all that has been more enforced and more common in all the states, not just, you know, not just the more organized ones, so that, you know, trailers actually do have a ID number, a VIN, vehicle identification number, and there's license plates to go with them and all that. But those plates can easily be drilled out and replaced with another plate, sometimes the numbers are actually stamped into the chassis. Well, it's not difficult at all to weld over the stamp, you know, grind it down flat and then restamp it. Another thing people don't think about, but I've seen it in posts and advertising and such, and it's just right out there in the open, people with VIN plates and title for sale. So if you happen to have a whatever trailer, you know, whatever brand it may be, you know, Acme brand trailer with that happens to be compromised because you know it was probably stolen, and you're looking for a clean way to get that back on the road, just poke around a little bit. There may be somebody with a tag and a good registration, a good title, and you just sort of adapt it to your trailer. You know, that's how a lot of people get around some of this stuff. So it's not that uncommon to find a way around even the legal barriers put up by the authorities. But let's get into it step by step. There's a lot of, you know, it sounds pretty simple, but there's a lot of things you can do, several things you can do to help prevent the thefts, and then things that I think it should be noted to, if there is a theft or once the theft does occur, what to do after that, and also things you can do to help make your trailer, even if it is stolen, less of a item, a barterable item, less of a item in trade, so we can get, you know, make it more difficult, and hopefully maybe people knowing that you've done these things would be less likely to take your equipment. But the number one thing is to, whether it's a truck or a or an SUV or whatever the vehicle is towing the trailer, the best thing to do to prevent that, especially the opportunity thieves, you know, somebody just driving by and just grabbing it, is to get a lock that actually locks the coupler to the tow ball or the frame of the vehicle pulling the trailer. So there is, you know, there's some manufactured items that take care of this. I mean, any Tractor Supply or Northern Tool or other supply house like that has these things in the trailer section, just locks that allow the tongue of the trailer to be locked to the hitch ball of the vehicle pulling it. In the event that you don't want to use a manufactured piece of equipment, you can also just get a really heavy grade chain and do it that way. You can either tie a loop around the connecting the tongue to the hitch ball, or connecting the tongue to a solid part of the chassis of the truck, and just use a good theft-proof or cut-proof lock. Most locks can be cut with a good bolt cutter, but some locks are especially hardened, and you know they're not cheap, but they can be purchased. And both a chain, a very hardened chain, and a hardened lock are really maybe not a 100% guaranteed proof, but a very good protection.
How much more do you know about that? Because I was going to mention that on the show today specifically, that probably I would say the majority of these master locks, these Brink locks, whether it's a key or a combination or whatnot, you know, you could go 2 aisles down the hardware store and buy for probably $19.95 to $59.95 just some bolt cutters that just like butter. Just, you remember high school lockers that the janitor would show up and just pop, and it's like no effort whatsoever. And so I've seen some when I was shopping for some locks for our gates at the homestead, some that were, you know, hardened or reinforced or coated or something. And some of them even had a particular strength associated with it based on how much it could tolerate from different types of cutters. Then you've got the ones that we've seen, if you've ever had anything in a storage facility before, they're round with a key in the center. And they don't have a lot of space where you could get bolt cutters in, per se, where the actual bolt slides from one side to the other. But then you turn it on, and you see, I think there's a show out there, what is it, the auction something or another, where, you know, they just get this round Dremel tool, it looks like, with a round blade on it, and cut right, I mean, in a matter of 10 seconds, it cuts right through that. So, what, Richard, do you know or can share? Is it just a matter of looking for those locks that say what hardened, or is there any, you know, something that we should look out for to maybe make it a little bit difficult? Maybe the average homeowner doesn't have the tool to cut right through those locks.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Most of the inexpensive locks, like the locker locks and the combination locks, and under $10 or whatever in that range, locks are not hardened steel. They're fairly soft. I mean, they're not really meant to be. They're meant to stop honest thieves, I guess, is the way
right.
I put it.
I've heard that.
But,
yeah, exactly. You're only going to stop the honest folks, right?
Yeah. But nobody expects that what you're going to have in your school locker or your work locker is going to be that valuable anyway. So that's fine. Just enough to keep prying hands out. But if you want to get protection, you do have to get a hardened lock. Now, just the word hardened doesn't really mean anything. I mean, people can probably, the manufacturers can legally say hardened and maybe put a finish on it or go to a better grade of steel. But you actually want to look for a grade, like bolts have different grades for hardness in automotive and engineering applications. So, you know, a grade 5 bolt is going to be less hard than a grade 8, and when you get up into the higher grades like that, the steel, the alloys are actually blended to contain much harder materials, like, you know, chromium, vanadium, some of the other materials that they put in metal nickel, that kind of thing, to make the steel a lot harder to cut through. And you know, harder it means brittle, more brittle as well. But they actually blend the steel to make it much less penetrable to something like a cutter. Now, as you said, somebody with a tool can likely get through the hasp of the lock or just the chain that the lock's connected to more easily, more successfully than somebody with a bolt cutter. You can get the Dremel tool is, you know, one way. That's a pretty small thing, but you can take a side cutter. Anybody who welds knows what a side cutter is. Just a sort of a fairly heavy handheld tool with a big grinding disc on it, and the disc may be 4 inches in diameter. But when that thing spins, it spins very quick, you know, very rapidly, and the edge of that cutting disc is spinning, moving along so fast that it really doesn't take long, especially for something like a, you know, a 15 amp handheld welding tool like that, or welding dressing tool. It'll spark through. It'll eat the metal up and just saw right through it and shed sparks all over the place. But it's through it in a matter of seconds. And the other thing possibly is somebody with a small torch kit, small welding torch kit, and they make very small ones, portable ones, could cut through a chain or a lock, you know, in a matter of 15 seconds without any, you know, without anybody really noticing it. So, you know, it's not like it's impossible, but these kind of things, I mean, that'd be almost like a planned theft, and it's not really that we're talking about. We're really talking about just the easy thefts and the opportunistic thefts, just like somebody walking by a car that's unlocked or with the window open and just noticing that somebody's smartphone's on the seat or somebody's pocketbook's on the seat and just, you know, reaching in the open window and popping the door open. And, you know, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. So what we're getting into here is just like with a decent lock that's made for the hitch of the vehicle and trailer, they'll skip right past over that because it's really not an easy removal. One thing I do want to mention before I move on to the next part of this is that these days, you know, it used to be some years ago, people would have a bumper hitch. It was basically a clamp bolted onto the back of the bumper, and this little ball thing sticking out, and that was your bumper hitch, and that was attached to the bumper, and or possibly a little thing that. That sort of attached somewhere onto the car, and it really wasn't much of a, you know, it was permanently attached to the car, and it wasn't really much of a, its tongue weight was limited, and its pulling load weight was limited. But these days, almost all the towing devices are attached to the frame, and they have a rectangular receiver that is, you know, welded to a series of bars, and the bars are either bolted or welded onto the frame of the vehicle or the subframe of the vehicle, and they're not attached to the bumper. So into that little square receiver goes a tubular steel ball attachment that the ball is actually hooked to, and that ball and a receiver tube is attached to the receiver part with a pin. Now, if you don't lock the pin, it's very easy just to pull the pin and take the whole receiver ball off the hitch part of the truck. So, and anybody who knows exactly what I'm talking about. It's a 3/8 inch steel pin that just is held in with a little clip, and you pull the clip, you yank the pin out, and the ball comes right out of the end of the receiver. So that's not going to do anybody any good except for the thief. So you have to make sure the pin that holds the receiver hitch ball into the receiver itself is locked as well. And those tools or those locks are also available in the stores where they sell the trailer equipment. So mainly whether it's a chain or a lock or a hitch lock, you need that, and you also need the receiver hitch lock to lock it all up, and that's the good way to do it. If you have if you have that all taken care of, and you want to be sure another way to be sure that the ball itself can't be removed, because that's another thing people do, is just take a big pipe wrench, and it really is not that difficult. A good pipe wrench onto the huge nut that attaches the ball to the receiver itself, undo the nut, and the ball comes off.
Yeah.
And the ball's going to come off with the trailer tongue and the trailer, and it's all good. I mean, it's a simple matter to just take it that way. If you would tack weld the threads on the end of the hitch bolt, the ball bolt, just running two or three beads down the threads, and of course that means you'll never be able to get the ball off yourself without cutting it off, but most people don't need to remove the ball anyway.
I'm picturing that now. You know, they've got so many people now have, like, say, the Class 3 receiver, and they have the bar that goes up into that, which they clamp, or cotter bolt with, and then they've got some that have, you know, you've seen them, three different size balls on that one shaft that goes up into the Class 3 receiver. But if you did want to do that, it's not that expensive. You can get actually the bar that goes up into that, the receiver, and then put whatever ball, 2 3/4, 2 1/8, a 2-inch ball. If you did weld it, then, like I said, I can't imagine being more than about $15-$20, and you've got one for each size ball, and they're welded, and there's no way they could get the ball off of that. Again, you just have to, like I'm sure you'll get to, get those locks for that pin that for the three, you know, for the class of receiver, are the ones that'll slot up into the hitch that have a key lock, I guess, and they don't have anything that you can actually. They're really weird. You'll probably get into those as well. But so even you could even have, because it's not all that expensive, to maybe have a separate bar with the ball welded on there. You just have three or four based on the sizes you need. Then there wouldn't be an issue for having to take it unweld it.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I have. My truck can haul 4,500 pounds on the tongue, or pull 4,500 pounds. So I keep my sizes would be 7/8 inch, or 1 7/8 inch, 2 inch, and then 2 1/4 inch. Anything bigger than that would be a much bigger truck. So those are 1 7/8 is probably the most common, and 2 inches is the next most common, and then the 2 1/4 is for pulling vehicle trailers and things. But I keep all three of them, and I bought receiver tongue things for all three of them, and welded each size ball onto each of the three receiver bars, and I just keep them in the truck, so I switch them around when needed. And you know, it's a good idea, just as an aside, it's a good idea not to keep the ball on the back of the receiver all the time if you don't have it locked, because you know, that's another opportunity. It's only $20 or $25, but somebody can pull the pin and just throw that thing in the back of their truck, or in under the seat of their truck or whatever, and
yep.
You know, they don't have to go buy one. You know, that's, people don't think about that, and I don't think it's a huge problem, but it certainly is something that happens. I mean, in these big parking lots, like big box stores or, you know, flea markets or whatever, that's not uncommon for people to come back, and of course they don't even notice it right away, but they get home and they say, "What happened to my ball?" You know, and you know, you're wandering around the flea market, or you're shopping for 3 hours, and you know, there's plenty of opportunity for mischief like that. The other thing to think about is, I know my little boat trailer is like this. The trailer tongue, the trailer, I guess it's called the tongue. The tongue itself is the bar, is the steel bar that is part of the trailer that your coupler hooks up to. The coupler is actually the ball-shaped cap that attaches to the tongue of the trailer, and both of those together, once they're together, they're all part of the trailer. And then you slip that coupler over the ball on your truck, and you know, snap that thing down, and away you go. Those couplers are actually often only bolted onto the front of that trailer tongue. They're not welded. If you bought the trailer new, they're probably they probably would be welded, but sometimes people put things together from kits, or it's a homemade trailer. They just, and you can just buy the coupler units by themselves to fit all sorts of tubular steel tongues for the trailers. You know, 2-inch, 2 1/4-inch, whatever, 2.5, whatever it might be. And as I said, a lot of those are just bolted on. Well, it doesn't really take a few swipes with a small welder, which a lot of people have these days. Even the 110 bolt garage hobby type welders will do the job. Just welding that coupler to the tongue, in addition to the bolts, will make sure that people just can't unbolt the coupler and remove the trailer that way. So that's a good, you know, that's a good point. The other thing is, you know, into more practical stuff, just thinking about how you leave your rig attended or unattended. You know, you pull up your truck and your trailer attached to the diner or to the McDonald's, whatever. You know, you really need to think about parking it in a place where you can either see it or having somebody stay behind, especially in a fast food situation. Somebody stay behind and everybody can come back out to eat, or somebody can bring out their meal to the person who's staying behind. It really is if you have a few buddies, it's just a really good idea to have somebody staying with the vehicle or the rig while the rest of the crowd goes in, because that's almost a surefire way of not being victimized. Somebody's with it, they're going to pass you right by, move on to a greener pasture, so to speak. If possible, try to, you know, park in a place where you can actually see, if you need to go inside, where you can actually see the trailer. If that's not possible, just make a choice not to sit down and eat. If you have to, have to just go in and get something as quickly as you can and come back out again, that's going to reduce the amount of time the trailer's left unattended, if it's not locked up correctly.
I don't have new to trailering, but that's why this show means a lot to me, because I don't have really any of this. I've got the class 3 receiver hitch, and then the actual, and I've got those expensive weight distribution hitches that slide up in there. I mean, just the piece that slides up into the receiver is over $200. And so, you know, and then I put my pin through, and I've got the cotter pin, and that's it. That's not locked, but I am a stickler about whenever I unhook, I put that right in the back of the SUV immediately, because I know that's just a slip the pin out and $200 is gone, and it's just the headache that would cause when up on the road, not just the expense, but now having to find one and the right one, and so that always goes in the back of the SUV, never ride around with it hanging out of the receiver. And then, you know, in fact, I can look at it right now. You are correct. Well, actually, mine is, mine is welded to the actual trailer, so that's good. The part that the ball goes up into with that latch. But what I have that goes through that latch, once it's connected to the ball and I pull the latch down to lock it, I just have a very simple stainless steel nut and bolt that goes through there. So I'm conscious of that. And like when I come back out of the Cracker Barrel or we're eating and we're on the road and we stop, rest stop, whatever, wherever we stop at, I always come out and I do a thorough walk around just to see. And I also look at that bolt and cotter pin that attaches that bar up into the receiver, because seriously, I mean, not to give, you know, people say, you shouldn't talk about that because you give people ideas. Believe me, there's nothing that nobody, especially bad people, hadn't already thought of. But literally somebody, while I and my family are in Cracker Barrel eating, I come outside, all they'd have to do is pull that cotter pin out, pull that bar out, I start to pull away, and boom, the bar falls out of the three-point hitch, or maybe they just pull the pin out, and nothing happens, so I'm on the road going 60 miles an hour, I hit the right bumps, that pin falls out because they pulled the cotter pin out, and now, you know, lives are in danger because of one little pin that somebody pulls out as a joke, maybe a teenager that doesn't think about the ramifications of doing something like that. So every time we stop, because I don't have any locking systems on my connectors, I always do a thorough walk around. I mean, I get paranoid sometimes. I look under the tires to see if anybody's put anything under my tires that would cause a blowout or cause a flat to take advantage of the quote-unquote tourists down the road. Hey, we'll put something under their tire that'll make it go flat.
We'll get on the highway and follow them. When their flat the tire does go flat, we'll pull up behind them and rob them, take advantage of them, whatever the case may be. So I guess I've read in too many horror stories, but as much time as we spend on the road, I feel it's very valid. So every time we come out, when we haven't been able to see or watch or anything, Cracker Barrel, sometimes those RV lots are behind the Cracker Barrel, I check everything, all my connectors and all my tires before we pull away. That may call me paranoid, but there's too many crazy people out there.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. Just beyond the theft, just the vandalism or the gee, wouldn't it be funny when this guy drives off his trailer falls out of the falls down the back of the bumper.
If people like that, absolutely.
And let's watch him. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's especially with the larger, you're actually towing an RV type thing or something, big, like a contractor's trailer or something with some real weight to it. It is well worth your while to make sure security is an issue with either removing that ball and assembly or having a lock for it. And then I wanted to talk just a little bit about also. What about trailers when they're not attached to the vehicle? That's even a better opportunity because it's all ready to go. They do make a coupler lock that just wraps over the entire the opening at the top at the bottom of the receiver portion. It just covers the whole thing, so the ball can't even be put in there. So somebody to steal the trailer would have to rig up some type of a chain. Mechanism or do something it would be so difficult to do on the spur of the moment that it wouldn't be really feasible. Using a stirrup or a hitch lock, I guess is the official word for it. It's just a mechanism that actually fits either around or fits into the portion where the ball would normally go. So it fills it up or covers it, and the ball cannot go into the opening, and it can't be hooked up properly. So that's one way, an easy way of doing it. The other thing is, like we talked about in the very beginning, just get yourself a length of chain, of good stout chain, and if you have the type of wheels that have spokes in them, which a lot of trailers do, they're usually a white wheel with five or six spokes where there's actually openings between each of the spokes, and I'm not even sure we'll call them spokes, but they're just web. It's like a web design wheel. It's not a solid wheel. And if you just slip your chain through one of those holes in the wheel itself, in the steel wheel, and then wrap it around the axle or a part of the frame of the chassis, part of the component of the chassis or frame of the trailer, the vehicle cannot be towed, even if the ball was able to be hooked up correctly and the hitch was able to be hooked up to another vehicle, it just wouldn't pull because the one wheel would be locked, stuck, and they'd have to drag it. It would be dragging and obviously go flat, burn up and go flat. The tire would burn in a matter of minutes.
That's awesome. I never really thought about that, but doing something like that as a preventative, but I guess you're back in the same boat as far as if it's not hardened, then a $20 pair of bolt cutters would go right through the lock you have the chain locked with or the chain itself. Correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely. You have to have a good, a good place for it is motorcycle supply houses or stores, whatever they sell. They sell, top-notch chains that are long enough to take care of this and top-notch locks that are strong enough to take care of this. So you could, if it's a trailer full of something worth it to you, like a, like tools or the trailer itself might be like your RV type trailer, it would be well worth your while looking into an investment like this. The thing I should mention, though, especially with a longer chain, you can envision this. You've got a chain around the wheel, and maybe a foot or so, and then it hooks, and then it wraps around something in the part of the frame of the trailer or the axle, whatever. It is still possible to get a jack that one wheel off the ground, take off the lug nuts, swing that wheel around and wire it up to the side of the trailer somehow and make it look like a spare tire, and then put your own wheel on there. I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but for a trailer that's parked, especially in a place where people can't see what's going on, that's very easily done. and then away you go. Then your locked wheel is actually removed out of the lug nuts and just stuck on the side of the trailer somewhere. You can do that with, like I said, with baling wire or with you know, with some other mechanism and just sort of hang it off the side of the trailer. The only way to stop that from happening is to purchase some lockable lug nuts, which are another thing you get at AutoZone or whatever. They're inexpensive, and you know, somebody, a thief seeing this kind of situation, your tongue's locked, your chain's here, chain's on the wheel, the chain's, you know, all this stuff going on. It's like, is it worth it? And probably not, but I guess a real determined thief will think, gee, there must be something valuable in that trailer. You wouldn't be going to all this trouble. But, you know, if that's the case,
and also,
they can,
you made it tough. You know, they're going to go after the easy target, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. That's right. I mean, if they want to bust into the trailer, they can just take a circular saw with a steel cutting blade on it or a demolition sawzall and cut right through the side of it, and they can take the wall in and get in there and see what's in there. So,
that's a lot of these Amish storage buildings. I've got one. We call it the barn. It's about 10 foot by 20 foot, and it's got the little key lock on it on the actual handle that you unlock it with. You know, and one door's double door. One door's got the interior slide bolts that hold it in place. The other one locks in, you turn the handle, and anyway. So I was thinking about ways to upgrade that, but at closer look, I'm like, all they have to do is take off the hinges and the doors fall right off.
yeah, that's,
you know, that's not, I mean, like you said, trying to keep, you know, the locks, you know, keep the honest people out, keep the honest people honest, you know, that type of thing. Nothing is perfect. It's like, you know, with your homes, if someone wants in, they're going to get in, alarm or not. But you know, if they see, you know, the alarm signs, if they see this, if they see that, you know, they just, oh yeah, let's go to another easier target than this one. Just not even take the chance and get the easy. It's kind of like a lot of, you know, in the area we live, we feel like, you know, we've got the alarm and the fence around the house and the dogs, things like that. Is that, you know, most folks in that area, they break in, they're going to want things that they can unload very quickly, sell to friends, sell to pawn shops, you know, a big fancy piece of artwork or maybe china, something like that, forget it. They want the quick smash and grab, something they can go to the pawn shop and sell, circular saw, cordless drill, things like that. They can easily get gone and make a little money for whatever they need the money for. So, yeah, I mean, I think that goes for trailers and I guess anything else for that matter, my theory.
Yeah. I mean, it's even in house construction, you know, people are getting more and more into less expensive, you know, some of the less expensive starter homes or, you know, vinyl siding and things like this. Well, you know, they can still meet the requirements for insulation value in the wall and get by with less expensive sheathing, but it gets to the point with vinyl siding and insulation that really, of course, isn't difficult to get through or hard, and drywall on the inside, it isn't that hard to just take a razor knife or, you know, a box cutter and get right through into the wall of the house. Doors can be as locked as you want them to be, but with a good utility knife, you can cut right through vinyl and insulation and kick through the drywall and in you go. I mean, it's not that difficult. So you got to sort of think your priorities through, I guess, when you're doing this. One other thing, just talking about the types of, you know, other things that can happen is boat owners, especially the propellers on a boat, the propeller on an outboard motor or inboard outboard. It's it's not cheap, and it's not very difficult at all to pop the cap off, or just a lot of people don't even have the little cap, but the nut's right there. Pull the cotter pin, undo the nut, and slip the prop right off there, and there's a easily had item that goes for quite a bit of money if it's new. So there are propeller locks. If people weren't aware of it who own boats, there are propeller locks that sort of the nut
I guess
that normally would
you
go
have
on
one of those fancy stainless propellers.
Oh yeah. It doesn't really matter what kind it is. If it's attractive to somebody, they're gonna take it. But so this nut, this locking nut, just or lockable nut, just sort of slips. It replaces the normal nut on the end of the on the end of the drive shaft of the lower part of the outboard, and once the propeller's on, it just locks it on, so it can't be removed without unlocking the device. But it can still the propeller can still operate on the boat. You don't have to you don't have to take anything off to make it work. It's mm-hmm. small enough and doesn't interfere with the operation of the boat or the motor when it's running. So that's just a little aside to think
hey,
about.
Hey, Peter, let me go ahead and take a little quick commercial break, and then when we come back, we can continue on. You there?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Let me take a commercial break. All righty, folks,
sure.
We're talking with Richard Frudenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine. We're talking about today's topic, preventing trailer theft there at your home, your homestead, or while even on the road. So great information we haven't had before. Hope you're taking lots of notes. You heard pertains to me specifically. I don't really have any locking mechanisms on specifically on the RV. I've talked to you about some of our paranoia while traveling on the road or leaving it behind the Cracker Barrel in the RV parking while we go in and have lunch with the family. But so it's something to look at and maybe start shopping for before we hit the road again. So stay tuned. There's a lot more information coming up with, again, Richard Frudenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine. Stay with us, folks.
When you need an incubator, think Brensea, the incubation specialist. Brensea has been a world-leading manufacturer of incubators for over 30 years. Incubators from 7 to 380 eggs with high-quality electronic and digital controls, including precise humidity control and programmable egg turning, all at surprisingly affordable prices. Visit them online at Brensea.com. Brensea spelled B-R-I-N-S-E-A. That's Brensea.com or call 1-888-667-7009. Enter the coupon code WHISPER at checkout and save 10% on their incubators, brooders, egg handlers, and other incubation accessories. When you need an incubator, think Brensea. Technology you can trust.
I don't know if you saw it yesterday, folks, but I posted on my Facebook page that Ideal Poultry had an emergency last-minute sale. Bantams were just 85 cents a piece. I believe you had to order 25, but a Facebook fan posted that they ordered 25 of these bantams. They came with shipping total to $33. That was for 25 bantams. So check out our Facebook page. We often post these specials from Ideal Poultry.
Ideal Poultry has been a family-owned and operated business since 1937. Their business is built on customer service and quality poultry, from rare white and brown egg layers to broilers, ducks, turkeys, and bantams. Ideal Poultry is the largest supplier of backyard poultry in the United States, shipping close to 5 million chicks annually. Visit them online at idealpoultry.com. That's idealpoultry.com. Pictures of chickens on aprons are common across America, but picture a chicken wearing an apron and you'll probably get a good chuckle. Laugh if you must, but nothing protects hens better than the Hen Saver Hen Apron. Hen Saver Hen Aprons protect your hens from the damage caused by an overly affectionate rooster and may even provide protection from an unexpected hawk attack. Hen Savers come in several different sizes to fit both bantam and standard-sized hens and roosters. Colors include camo, denim, navy, brown, khaki or black, and soon pink. Crazy K Farm is expanding its already colorful Hen Saver collection to include the color pink. A portion of their sales will be donated to organizations that fund breast cancer research and awareness. Order your Hen Saver aprons today at hensaver.com. That's hensaver.com.
Introducing the Chicken Fountain, a new way to water your flock. The Chicken Fountain will change your life and keep your chickens healthier by providing clean, fresh water every time. No more daily cleaning of dirty chicken waterers. This semi-sealed system keeps every drop of water fresh and clean. Proudly made in the USA, the Chicken Fountain will provide your flock with fresh, clean water for years to come. To order your chicken fountain, visit chickenfountain.com. That's chickenfountain.com.
This looks like a job for
Super Chicken.
You get the super sauce, I'll don my super suit.
Alrighty, folks, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. Our guest today, we've had a great lineup all week long. Our guest today, Richard Frudenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine. Please visit them online, backhomemagazine.com. And you can actually subscribe right there online instantly, no problems there. Or you can give them a call. The phone number is posted on their website. You can call and talk to a real human being right there in North Carolina and order your year-long subscription and, you know, go back, listen to the archives of our shows, the second and fourth Thursday of every month. And a lot of great information there from Richard and Back Home Magazine website, backhomemagazine.com. And today we're talking about really preventing trailer theft, all kinds, from wood splitters to RVs to the landscape trailers to the box storage trailers, you name it. And you probably have known someone who's had a trailer stolen full of goodies for whatever reason. But we're talking about trying to prevent that today. And I'm having to take heed and learn myself. It's brought up a lot of what-ifs here as much as we travel on the road with our RV and the what-ifs that can happen. So welcome back, Richard. Thanks for joining us again.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's I was looking in the chat room while you were talking. It's quite lively comments today on that board.
Yeah, you never know when the chat room is gonna. We never know where it's gonna go. That's for sure. With depending on whoever's in that any particular day, it could go just about absolutely anywhere. But lots of great information in there. And unfortunately, the majority of our listeners listen to the archive, which is still great. We love them because they listen to the full show, including the commercials, so our sponsors are happy with that. But, and sometimes they just don't have the right browser to get in the chat room, so sometimes it's kind of light in there, but I hate to discontinue it because the few that can get in the chat room every day, they seem to really like it and have made some great friends through the chat room. So we still keep it up for everybody. But, yeah, you just never know what's going to happen in there. It has its own kind of personality, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay, so we talked about the physical things as far as, locks and covers and welding and chains and hardened hardware. Now maybe some preventative means that will help recovery if the trailer is stolen. Or maybe if some of these are visible, then it would actually be a deterrent. One of the most common things to do is to anything that you can do to inscribe an identification number onto either the trailer frame or onto any part or equipment that goes with your trailer. I mean, it could be electronic equipment in a boat, or it could be the trailer frame itself, or it could be a pump or a generator, just whatever. Both the trailer and the equipment in it can be inscribed with a there's a tool you can use to you can purchase stamps that you can actually slug with a hammer, and it'll put an alphanumeric stamp in there. You know, it has the 0 to 9 digits and then all the letters of the alphabet, or you can just buy a rotary tool that grinds you can grind a figure into metal with it. But one of the best things to do is, instead of in the old days it was inscribe your social security number. That's not a good idea these days for obvious reasons. One practice is to put two letters first and say if it was Georgia, say GADL, meaning Georgia driver's license, or NCDL or WYDL, whatever it might be, and then just inscribe your driver's license number behind that, or any combination of those things, and you'll have your driver's license number, which can tie right back to you with your license when you present your license with that number on it to an officer if they retrieve your equipment. You can say, "This is me. I did this inscription, you know, a year and a half ago to identify my equipment." The state's on there. The DL represents driver's license, and the number is your number. So that's that's a real good idea. And and it can easily trace, you know, they can easily check that by tracing it through the state database to make sure you're the person that is the legal owner. And it
there
also
was a question
ties
in the chat room just posted up. How effective are the electronic bugs that you can track, like LoJack? And are they, do you know if they're available to put on a trailer, or does it have to have a battery, some type of power to connect to activate it, or internal antenna or whatnot? Or have you heard of people putting LoJack on any type of trailers or some type of that system?
I have not, only for maybe a motorcycle racing teams, or you know, people
uh-huh.
who actually are out in the wilderness with a lot of valuable equipment in a trailer. That would be one way. I believe those systems are self-powered, and they, of course, they're normally made to go in vehicles themselves. But that would be something to look into. I guess the answer to that is I'm not sure. I'm sure it would work if it could get power, but you know, I wonder how much. I mean, if it depends on how valuable
right.
your trailer is. I mean, just there's a limit.
Yep. But
I saw that myself. I was just looking at that. The other thing to do is, like, on a boat. You know, some of these would be particular to boats or vehicles, really, ATVs or other pieces of equipment, but with the boat itself, they themselves are titled and registered. So beyond just the trailer, if you have a boat on the trailer, you can inscribe the boat's hull number, what's called the HIN. It's just like the VIN on a vehicle, but it's the HIN, the hull number, hull identification number. Inscribe that somewhere on the boat in several places, so you can also have that on your boat in case it's stolen. You know, you can make a point of pointing that out because you have the paperwork for your own boat. And you're of course do the same thing with the trailer. You want to add the vehicle identification number of the trailer to the frame in another place other than where it normally would be, so that if somebody takes the official tag off or grinds down the official stamp, you'll have the your own version of it hidden somewhere else on the frame so that you can use it as identification. Here's another little point that most people don't think of. On a boat, paint the name on the transom of the boat, on the back of the boat, and you know, with a good grade of paint that is not easily removed. Once the boat's identified that way, it's not that it can't ever be taken off, but it's difficult to resell a boat that's identified this way legally. I mean, it's another step to make it more difficult, because then the person is going to have to take that transom and, you know, grind it all off or sand it down, whatever, repaint it completely without the name or with a different name. It's just more difficult. So that's a, you know, simple little thing. A lot of people already have their names on there, boat's name on there, but it makes it easy to one more step to prevent or to at least deter theft. And the other thing, you know, the other common sense thing, I mean, people do it with TVs, radios, firearms, you know, rifles, shotguns, CB radios, all sorts of things. Keep a record of every piece of equipment you think is valuable. Keep a record of it in a separate location in your house or in your bank lockbox or somewhere, and keep it updated. So every piece of equipment you have that has a number on it, an ID number or serial number, record those in your computer or on a piece of paper, and you know, lock it somewhere. If you're traveling,
yeah, Bob,
with the trailer,
Bob in the chat room said that he takes a picture of everything on his digital camera and then has it on a jump drive or in two-plate jump drive and his computer. Storage, again, all his firearms, all of the stereo equipment, everything. Got a picture of it in case something should happen. And I guess there's ways to record the serial numbers of a lot of those as well. Somehow, I know the insurance company or the police will want to, well, what's the serial number on your laptop? I could tell you right now to save my life. So serial number on laptop, stereo equipment, cameras, things like that. But he keeps a picture of everything.
Exactly. That's, in fact, that was one of the points I was going to make, and he beat me to it. That's terrific. You can even take a picture of the VIN on the frame.
Uh-huh.
You can get to it. I mean, if you can see it, if it's in place where you can actually get, that's, you know, that's also, because that'll provide the color, the background, the way in which it's attached and all that stuff. So that makes it easy. But absolutely, and you can, of course, if you've got a smartphone, you can record this information right in the phone. But if not, even on a piece of paper, when you're traveling, you know, keep it with you, because if you're on the road and you're camping somewhere and the trailer gets stolen and you have to deal with the local authorities, you're the one that's prepared. You look better to them. You're making it easier for them, and they're going to double check it on databases. But at least you can pull out a piece of paper and say, okay, my trailer number was this number, my boat number was this number, whatever, and they'll think, you know, this guy's worth working with because he's well organized. You know, this only happened an hour ago. Maybe we'll be able to catch up with this. And you know, sometimes the local law enforcement is so busy they may not really jump on something like this. I mean, you wait too long, you're arguing with them instead of cooperating with them and all that. It's, you're not going to make a good victim. You know, I'm just throwing that out there. The other thing to do is yes, we already talked about taking photos of your stuff. The other thing is don't hide ignition keys in the boat. If you know, we're still talking about boats, don't put a spare key in the boat or a spare key for any equipment really. Because that's something that is, most people know where you would put that in the boat. I mean, they can reach underneath, you know, behind the transom or underneath the pilot's wheel or whatever, and just sort of find it. So it's a good idea not to. And most insurance companies frown on that anyway, keeping spare keys in the vehicle, because that's an open invitation to theft. Again, that could be more for professional thieves, but you know, it doesn't take a really bright person to feel around a little bit and just see, gee, I wonder if there's a spare key, especially in a boat where the spare key is probably likely to be on some kind of a floating device. So you know, it's a bulky thing. The other thing to point out is insurance is going to go a long way towards protecting things once the theft is done. I mean, especially with a boat or a log splitter or a camping trailer or something like that. These are often policies that are riders to your existing homeowner's policy, but you know, you should look into the cost of protecting these, you know, it's worth looking into. You know, it may be prohibitive cost for some people, but it's up to you and balancing the value of your equipment against the cost of the policy. But you know, it's worth at least looking into it through your insurance agent. The other thing is the other part of this is once you are the victim of the theft, you really need to immediately contact local law enforcement agencies, because as soon as you can get to them. With cell phones, it's fairly easy these days. As soon as you can get to them, the sooner they can start looking for a license number or a vehicle description in the vicinity, in and around the vicinity that it was stolen from, especially if you're traveling, if you're in a diner or in a campground or something like that, and you come back, you went off for a walk, and you came back, and your camper's stolen or whatever, or your, you know, your trailer with the bikes, with the motorbikes on it, or your Trek bicycles or whatever is gone. At least you can say I'm at the, you know, the Northwoods campground, and 10 minutes ago the trailer was here. Well, they can look. It includes the sheriff's department, local police. If there's a town police, that's important. State police. Usually, once you contact one, they are all contacted. But it doesn't hurt to make sure that's taken care of. They'll need serial numbers, descriptions, all that kind of thing, so they can enter it into the National Crime Information Center database, and that will help speed recovery, especially if you are in a part of the state where you're bordering another state, because, you know, people cross the border. If it's 20 minutes away and they're going in that direction, they're in another state, and often by just reporting it to one state, you're not including the neighboring states, mm-hmm. and that's a mistake. You want to include everybody so that somebody hooks it onto the back of their truck and shoots off into Tennessee or Alabama or whatever. You're going to be covered that way, at least in helping to look.
Richard, I've got 60 seconds.
Okay.
The show, so however you can wrap or want to wrap up in 60 seconds,
yeah.
And we'll get cut off.
Yeah, okay. Well, real quick, the other thing, if you with a boat, is you want to notify your state boat registration authority. With us, it's the wildlife authorities. They handle boat registrations in your state, whoever it may be. It's the state who just handles those registrations because they also can look on the water for your vehicle, for your boat. So that's all I have, really. I mean, it's like a 20-point item, or 20 items, it's all worthwhile.
That's great information. Next time I head to the camper store or the Wally World, I'll look and see what I can do to upgrade, make our trip safer when we are on the road. Richard Frutenberger, publisher of Backcold Magazine, findbackmagazine.com. Thank you, Richard, again for coming on the show. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Okay, good deal.
All right, thank you so much. All right, that's going to wrap up another episode of Backyard Poultry with Chicken Whisperer. Great episode today, great lineup all week long. We'll have another great lineup next week, so we'll see you back here Monday with Ask the Chicken Doctor with Peter Brown. Until then, we hope you have a wonderful and blessed weekend with family and friends. God bless everybody.